This is 40A&M N5, a weekly download of 40A&M LLC. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40A-M.com. HBO, soon to be streaming to a device near you. Twitter files a lawsuit alleging prior restraint of First Amendment rights. Why does the consumer cloud continue to be misunderstood? And Silicon Valley's latest moves to attract and keep top female talent. That's not all, but it's a start. Welcome back to 40A&M in 5, the weekly download of 40A&M LLC. It's Monday, October 20th, and I'm Chris Bohm. First up, coming soon to an internet near you, it's HBO. That's right. HBO Chairman and CEO Richard Plepler announced on October 15th that beginning in 2015, HBO will be offering a streaming service to those considered cord cutters and other non-subscribers on an a la carte basis. Not a lot of detail was provided this past week on how the content will be organized, provisioned, and streamed, only that it will be a standalone over-the-top HBO service. And it's unclear whether the service will provision every HBO show or if archival material will also be available. Also, no mention was made of how much the service will cost. Nonetheless, HBO's decision is a big one for the content creating community, as it signals a sea-changing adjustment in flexibility for content delivery. As National Public Radio's Linda Holmes commented this past week, it seems inevitable that an arrangement like this will unsettle cable providers who have been able to use legitimate access to premium networks like HBO as one of the remaining barriers against cord cutting, the practice of declining to have a cable subscription in favor of watching content online. This past week, Twitter filed a lawsuit against the U.S. government over First Amendment rights. Since the NSA whistleblower Edward Snowden leaked information in June 2013 regarding the PRISM program, a number of top tech companies, including Google, Facebook, Microsoft, and others, were largely left in the position of not being able to deny or confirm how much information they had given to the U.S. government in support of the surveillance agenda. Microsoft, Facebook, LinkedIn, and Google reached a settlement with the U.S. government in January 2014, a settlement that permitted these companies to provide customers very general numbers within defined ranges of 0 to 999 requests and 1,000 to 1,999 requests, regarding how many requests had been made for user information. In a separate proceeding, Apple was able to get the government to agree to a lower range of 0 to 249 requests, and now each of these companies have released transparency reports, indicating within these ranges roughly how many requests they've received. However, Twitter did not join in the January 2014 settlement, primarily because its particular situation is different. Twitter's posts are public, which means that they don't actually get that many requests that relate at all to national security. As a result, they wanted to preserve their freedom to make that known to users. Their suit now stems from the treatment of a draft copy of Twitter's July transparency report that Twitter had provided to the government in April. The government told Twitter that they could not publish it, even if the report simply were to say that Twitter had received no requests. For with the 2014 of January settlement, even if one of the signing companies receives no requests for access to user data, the company is unable to show that they have not been targeted. Even a non-request can only be depicted in the context of a bucket of 0 to 249 requests. To Twitter, this could amount to portraying a lie to their customers, and the suit alleges that it is an example of government prior restraint, a gag order preventing the exercise of First Amendment rights. No doubt this case will be watched closely in the coming months, but for more information and for a very good discussion of the legal principles involved, see the article published this past Friday by Brett Kaufman, who is the supervising attorney to the Technology Law and Policy Clinic at New York University's School of Law. It's available at www.justsecurity.org. Two studies this past week took aim at issues wrapped up in young people online, and the degree to which we should be paternalistic with controls on their experiences. One study, reported on by the BBC on October 15th, had been conducted by the marketing agency Digital Clarity, and it found that 16% of the 18-to-25-year-old surveyed displayed symptoms of what is called net addiction. Now, previous studies have suggested that internet addiction, which the BBC piece says is an umbrella term for a variety of behaviors, operates in a similar way to drug or alcohol addiction, in that it involves release in the body of the chemical dopamine. In the paper published last week in the Journal of Addictive Behaviors and taken up in the BBC article, Dr. Andrew Doan tracked 5 signs of possible net addiction. First, is spending hours online. Second, is becoming irritable when interrupted during web use. Third, is feeling guilty about how much time is spent online. And isolation from family and friends due to excessive online activity. And finally, a sense of euphoria when online versus panic when offline. In contrast to these findings, the Oxford Internet Institute and the advocacy organization Parent Zone in the UK believes that their research supports a preference for parents to permit teens to self-regulate net use, to an extent. In this study, researchers surveyed more than 2,000 children aged 15 to 17 across the UK, and the report came to 3 main conclusions. 1, that children who have positive offline relationships with their parents are more likely to navigate the web in a sensible way. 2, supportive and enabling parenting has a more positive impact than restricting or monitoring internet use. And 3, teenagers left to self-regulate their internet and social media use are more likely to teach themselves new skills online and maintain positive offline relationships. In some respects, the study conclusions seem contradictory in that researchers emphasize that there is no replacement for good parenting, and they agree that age-appropriate boundaries should be applied to teens in an online world. The BBC's Jane Wakefield helpfully provides data from Ofcom, the UK telecommunications regulator, to give context to the study results. The most recent Ofcom report has 71% of UK children surveyed from ages 5 through 15 that had access to a tablet at home, and 88% access the internet via PC or laptop. And among 12 to 15-year-olds interviewed by Ofcom, the average time spent online was more than 17 hours per week. Thus, the takeaway from the Oxford Internet Institute Parent Zone results could perhaps be that if, as a parent, you apply age-appropriate boundaries and restrictions to your children's online experience, but are otherwise an engaged parent who supports appropriate exploration and learning by doing, you are likely hitting the mark. Two weeks ago, we briefly talked about the fact that a gallery in Florida had planned an exhibition of the hacked celebrity photos we've all heard so much about. Purportedly, the gallery exhibit was planned in part to help inure society to an increasing lack of privacy in the digital age. Thankfully, the outcry largely served to underscore that decency and good taste is not something that most are looking to be inured of, and the exhibition was canceled. But despite this cancellation, it hasn't dampened the odd occasional interjection to blame the victim or victims. Why this message keeps rearing its ugly head truly is a head-scratcher. As the pictures were in the cloud accounts of the targeted celebrities, the hack required that the security of the accounts be breached, whether by brute force, technical hack, or by a phishing or other scheme. If you happen to have a private naked picture of yourself and keep it in a location that you believe is secure, in this case the private consumer cloud, the message simply cannot be that you are proverbially asking for trouble. The same logic would imply that law firms should never trust digitally stored and network-accessible copies of draft memoranda, or financial regulators should never draft research in a portable digital format. The list goes on. Günther Oettinger, European Commissioner Designate for the Digital Agenda, issued a statement on September 30th in relation to the hack, stating that everyone has the right to privacy. The European Commission called for a European cloud strategy in 2012 and continues to campaign for safe cloud computing. The reference back to the 2012 strategy is very helpful, but as the EU digital agenda has long emphasized promotion of cloud deployment and take-up, it would be hard to imagine anything less. For its part, as we've discussed over the past few weeks, Apple is doing its part to both strengthen its own cloud security and help to improve user security habits through messaging. Even the celebrities themselves have not been blaming the cloud. So for the rare few who are saying that consumer cloud may not be for the faint of heart, what gives? Part of the answer may lie still in not understanding what the cloud is, and that a backup to the cloud or utilizing software in the cloud is not akin to an open posting to social media. But of course, Part of the answer may be due to a period in which we still find ourselves. In the wake of the Snowden revelations, it's been estimated that the U.S. cloud computing industry alone could stand to lose from $35 to $180 billion over the next 3 years. Thus, the cloud certainly does need policy help, but not friendly fire. As Nathan Pierce wrote for The Guardian back in February, to the extent that these worries about the cloud continue, they primarily revolve around the data, how secure it is, who has access to it, and where it's located. As we may have learned the hard way in the context of the current picture hack, passwords can continue to be a threshold security issue, as they always have been. Many still use the same passwords across multiple online services, Twitter, Facebook, Amazon, and so on, which is a dangerous game to play. The overarching problem here, of course, is trust. By improving trust through messaging and efforts like those undertaken by Apple in the wake of the hack, people will be more likely to embrace the benefits of cloud computing, such as lower costs and improved scalability. But this trust can only be built in if the user, whether consumer or business, is completely aware of the types of data that they will be putting into the cloud environment and the security that their provider is applying. In June, ZDNet profiled Microsoft's strategy to create consumer-centric and, as they put it, virally consumable cloud services that they will continue to want and work with in the enterprise business environment. Certainly, businesses have greater flexibility to contract for the right type of cloud service tailored to their particular needs, whether it be public, private, or hybrid solution. But once you understand what you are getting as a service, how it is secured, and what you put into that space that is your own, options are there for businesses and consumers alike to pick a cloud model that works for them. When it comes to the gender pay gap, particularly in white-collar industry positions, the tech industry is apparently better than some fields. As Harvard University economist Claudia Golden told the Financial Times this past week, women engineers in tech make 89 U.S. cents for every dollar that their male colleagues earn, compared to 66 cents in finance and 71 cents per dollar in law. But that may be because women engineers are so rare. As the Financial Times' Brooke Masters reports, 5 out of every 6 tech employees at Microsoft, Google, and Facebook are male. And the West Coast tech companies may not be winning any awards for promoting women either, with the latest statistics from Microsoft showing that while women make up 29% of its total workforce, including female non-tech workers, they are just 17% of its leadership. Google and Facebook do slightly better on the senior ranks, according to Brooke Masters, at 21% and 23% respectively. But it may be this past week's announcement by Facebook and Apple that has set a new bar for tech company enticement to engineering's female best and brightest. Both companies are offering up to $20,000 for U.S. employees covered by their insurance plans to finance the extraction, freezing, and storage of eggs for female employees. Facebook has been offering the service in the U.S. since the start of this year, and Apple is poised to follow suit as of January 2015. No doubt, the competition for recruiting talented female staff in Silicon Valley is fierce, and the policies are designed to attract and keep top female talent by helping them to avoid having to choose between motherhood and advancing in their profession. One of the week's best stories has to be one covered this past Tuesday by National Public Radio's Bill Chappell. It's the story of Anna Storr of Plainview, Minnesota. On Wednesday, Ms. Storr had a birthday party in Plainview. She turned 114 years old. That alone should be the story, but as NPR reports, what caught the media's eye this past week was the fact that she had tried very recently to create for herself a Facebook account. She hit a snag. Facebook's server software is unable to generate an account for someone who claims to be of an age that requires 3 digits. Apparently, she isn't the only one to have this initial difficulty. Facebook's drop-down menu for account creation doesn't go earlier than 1905. Ms. Storr improvised. She said that she was a sprightly 99. As NPR reports, Anna Storr was 3 years old when the Wright brothers took their first historic flight in an airplane at Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. And as highlighted by her family, when she was born, her family had neither telephone nor car, or for that matter, electricity. However, her son Harlan, a youthful 85, recently got her an iPad and an iPhone. From there, the fun began. She now does video chats and has her own Facebook account, with 31 friends. And that will be all for us again this week. You have been listening to 40ANM in 5. For more information and for our terms of use, visit 40a-m.com. All stories for this week's download were reported by at least 2 online or print news sources, or taken directly from relevant releases, with the exception of specific reporting highlighted from justsecurity.org, the BBC, The Guardian, ZDNet, The Financial Times, and National Public Radio. Thank you for listening. 40ANM in 5 will be back with you again on Monday, October 27th. Until then, of course, make this week and every week one to remember. And bye for now.